Jenny Lawrence, a former trustee and a longtime member of the library, and it gives me great pleasure to introduce Bob Peck this evening. Bob has spent his career at Philadelphia's Academy of Natural Sciences, where he is now curator of art and artifacts and senior fellow. Founded in 1812, the Academy is the country's first natural history institution. I met Bob while working at Natural History Magazine at the American Museum of Natural History, an upstart institution compared to the New York Society and to the Academy, as it was founded as recently as 1869. An outstanding article Bob wrote for the magazine was called "The Museum That Never Was," a plan in the 1860s cooked up by artist William Holbrook Beard and a wealthy businessman named Henry Key before the present museum was built. Visitors would enter the museum through an underground entrance from Central Park, guarded by colossal stone figures representing ignorance and superstition. They would go past the menagerie of grotesque antediluvian animals of immense size before climbing stone stairs into the museum proper, progressing, as it were, from barbarism to civilization, into a gallery filled with artistic depictions of, quote, the famous characters of recent times, our statesmen, soldiers, martyrs, and poets, the type of a perfect civilization. Needless to say, this monumental confection was never realized. I cite this digression to show the amazing material that Bob unearthed from the dusty archives. But he's not just a scholar and researcher. He's had the enviable job of fellow of the Academy, a special position that allows him to accompany the Academy's far-flung scientific expeditions around the world, documenting them in words and photographs. Author of numerous articles, 5 previous books, including a history of the Academy on its bicentennial, he has survived and chronicled expeditions to Nepal, Ecuador, Botswana, Namibia, Siberia, Mongolia, and more. But what nearly did him in was close to home, on his way to work last November when he was struck by a car. Suffering multiple fractures that were nearly fatal, Bob spent 25 days in intensive care and subsequent months convalescing. His recovery, I'm happy to say, has been 100%. And earlier this year, Bob was back again on an Academy expedition to the Amazon. Natural history illustration and art have been enduring fascinations for Bob, particularly Edward Lear's extravagant gifts as an artist and his astonishing range of work, published and unpublished. Bob's odyssey in search of Lear's illustration and art has stretched over many years and taken him into many archives and far afield. I suspect one of the reasons he fought so hard to survive his near rush with death last November was to finish this project. He has the glorious results. Please join me in welcoming Bob Peck.
Good evening, everyone. So glad you're here tonight. I'm so glad to be back at the New York Society Library, which is one of my favorite libraries anywhere. I think if Edward Lear had lived in the United States and been lucky enough to live in New York, he might well have wanted to be a member here, because he loved books. And fortunately, this library has a remarkable collection of Lear-related books, both Lear by Lear and about him. And Sarah has put out a smattering of them, I think there are 35 or more in the library. But she's put out examples in case you wish to browse through them later this evening. Now, I'm glad to see some friends, familiar faces in the audience, but I know most of you are here because you, like me, are great lovers of Edward Lear. Your parents may have read his books to you when you were little, and you in turn may have read them to your children and grandchildren. And if you haven't, I hope you will begin to do so. When our children were about the age of 7 or 8, they loved to, every time I would read to them when we went to bed, they would always ask for the nonsense book, which they called the nosy book. And you can see why. There are lots of pictures with people with long noses. I think I probably would have called it the bird book. there. But there were many cartoons of other subjects in his famous alphabet books that included bears and owls, monkeys riding on zebras' backs, storks and frogs and guinea pigs, turtles, owls, and what else do we have here? Cats, of course, and even kangaroos. And of course, he drew lots of cartoons of people, including this one, which I think he intended to be a picture of himself, surrounded by his favorite birds and reading books. He's reading, you can just barely make it out there, but it does say Edward Lear on the title page. He's wearing a frock coat that's at least a generation out of style, and his funny turned around feet in a long way. It's very Learian. His limericks have earned him a worldwide following of people of all ages, and a place in Poets' Corner in Westminster Abbey, immediately next to Lewis Carroll, the other 19th century nonsense poet with whom he's most often compared. And strangely, the two of them never met. They had mutual friends, but their paths never crossed, whether that was intentional or not. I haven't been able to determine. In 1988, to commemorate the bicentennial of Edward Lear's death, the British Postal Service issued four stamps celebrating Lear's unmatched wit and artistic flair. These included a self-caricature of the bearded artist flying with improbably minuscule wings, a sketch of the two protagonists from the album Pussycat, his most famous poem, a drawing of Lear's beloved stub-tailed cat, Foss, and a limerick illustration of a bonneted lady on whose hat a flock of imaginary birds is attempting to roost. The affable Lear would have been astonished and no doubt pleased by his country's philatelic attention, but almost certainly disappointed by the choice of images with which the Royal Mail chose to mark the centennial of his death. He considered the illustrated limericks and other nonsense verse only an incidental sideline to his more serious focus on natural history and landscape painting. In fact, the artist so feared that his nonsensical flights of fancy, that is, his nonsense poetry, would undermine his reputation in the scientific world, he refused to have his name associated with their publication until decades after they had already won for him the devoted followings around the world. We tend to think of Edward Lear as a jolly, rotund Victorian with a wonderful sense of humor, a man who made children laugh by gently poking fun at the improbable foibles of eccentric adults not too unlike himself. All of this is certainly one part of Edward Lear. But the Lear I want to tell you about this afternoon is a younger, lighter, slightly more serious man, an artist who dazzled the scientific world with paintings of birds, the likes of which no one had seen before. It's a wonderful story of a modest, self-deprecating, self-taught talent reshaping the worlds of art and science while winning a place in the hearts of generations of children he never met. It's the story of a man whose life was perfectly timed to coincide with those interesting years of the British Empire in which naturalists, in newly settled colonies of Australia, India, and Africa were collecting and sending to London an astonishing array of new birds, mammals, reptiles, amphibians, insects, and plants. These, in turn, fostered an appetite for books among the aristocracy and the rising middle class. My love of Lear as a natural history painter grew directly from his pictures, but my impetus for writing a book about it came from my longtime friend and mentor, Sir David Attenborough, who first proposed the idea to me more than 25 years ago. I've written and published a number of other books since, but his encouragement through the years has kept bringing me back to Lear and his remarkable achievements. Sir David's friendly proddings ultimately resulted in the book that has just been published by David Godin. The book is divided into two sections. The first and largest part is on Lear and his interest in natural history. The second is about Lear's influence on other artists over time. This evening I will present in my lecture sort of a summarized view of these two parts, devoting about three quarters of my talk to Lear and showing as many images of his work as I possibly can. And then I'll close with a few of the artists who are carrying on in his tradition today. To put all of what I'll say tonight in context, I'd like to begin with Lear's remarkable family history. He was the 20th of 21 children, born in 1812 to a middle-class family in a village suburb north of London. A reversal of family fortune when he was just 4 years old caused the family to disperse, and Lear was raised by his oldest sister, Anne, some 21 years his senior. It was Lear's artistic talent and appealing personality, rather than his family connections, that would ultimately take him from a modest upbringing in northern London to Osborne House on the Isle of Wight and Buckingham Palace, where in 1846 he served as the drawing instructor to Queen Victoria. He ended his days on the Italian Riviera after traveling the world with pencil and brush in hand. But I'm getting ahead of myself and ahead of Lear's amazing life story. Let me return to the very beginning of Lear's artistic career. While not a great deal survives from this period, we're fortunate to have several albums created between 1827 and 1830, when Lear was just 15 or 16 years old. At least two of the albums were evidently created by Anne Lear, who was a talented artist in her own right, with the help of Edward, who was, under her tutelage, then just learning the rudiments of drawing. So similar in style are many of the pictures in these albums that were some of them not signed, it would be almost impossible to say who painted which. The pheasants on the left are clearly signed by Anne. See the signature there. The birds on the right could be by either Anne or Edward, though I suspect the latter, for there are many others that are very similar in style that do bear his distinctive signature. One thing you will notice in all of these early works is that both the botanical illustrations and the birds tend to be very colorful and highly imaginary. It is possible that this early work by the Lear siblings was inspired by the so-called fancy bird porcelain, ceramics that were then being made in England and Germany. It's also possible that Lear and his older sister were hoping to sell their designs to one of the English manufacturers of the day, and perhaps they did. This is an area that still needs new research. At about the same time he was making his fanciful paintings of birds, Lear was also making very accurate studies of plants under the influence of another sister named Sarah. Also, as revealed in his albums, he was beginning to make some bird paintings that were based more on living birds than on his imagination. This red and yellow macaw, for example, shows a childlike treatment of landscape coupled with a very original and realistic pose and attitude of the bird itself. This is almost certainly a bird painted from life by a young Edward Lear, whose ability to capture the vitality of his subjects would only improve with time. Elsewhere in the albums are images that move dramatically from the imaginary world of his childhood to the very real world of the London Zoo, which opened to the public just as Lear was growing interested in natural history. This page in one of Lear's youthful albums makes it very clear that Lear was getting his inspiration from living birds. And I'm showing you here, this is the page from the album on the left. And then this is just a detail drawn right from here. four of the five feathers are real parrot feathers glued to the pages. The one in the center is a watercolor, however, probably a European jay. And so we see in these three pages, all from the same album, the coming of age of Edward Lear as a natural history painter, who could combine accurate depictions of the birds he saw with an irreverent, joyful attitude that infuses his subjects with life. Scientific illustrations of the 18th and early 19th century tended to be still and lifeless, even when the subjects were alive, as in these two birds by Eliezer Alwyn. Specimens were generally shown in profile against white backgrounds like this. Trees and branches were sometimes used as necessary devices to support specimens, most of which were drawn from skins rather than from living birds. The same was true with books on mammals. Edward Lear and his American contemporary, John James Audubon, were about to change that. Compare, for example, these stiff, lifeless mammals from Edward Godman's American Natural History, published in 1826, with these life studies of mammals by Edward Lear, painted only a few years later. Or these bird plates by Alexander Wilson, with these watercolors by Edward Lear. I'll say more about the style of Lear's painting shortly. For the moment, let me continue the story of Lear's emergence as an artist. While he was still in his teens, he made small amounts of money drawing what he described as, quote, uncommon queer shop sketches, and, quote, making morbid disease drawings for hospitals and certain doctors of physic. Unfortunately, none of these anatomical drawings have survived, or if they have, they've been unidentified as coming from Lear. But they were probably very much like the ones that you see hanging in this anatomical lecture hall on the wall. In fact, any one of these could easily have been done by Lear. This is painted at exactly the same time as he's doing those works. Because his medical illustrations were so grim, we can well imagine Lear's delight when he was asked to create some illustrations for William Bennett, a founder and longtime officer of the Zoological Society of London. Bennett asked him to supply a number of vignettes to enliven a two-volume work on the animals at the zoo that he was then writing. Strangely, and unfortunately for Lear, his work was not acknowledged in the book. We know of his contributions only because he inserted his subtle but distinctive EL monogram in the backgrounds on two of the illustrations. You can see it here. It's almost like the British pound sign for the pound sterling. Right in this part of the picture here. And there's another one just down here under these macaws. Though no doubt pleased to be published at all, Lear was determined not to remain anonymous for long. Sometime in 1827 or 28, possibly before the Zoological Society even opened its doors to the public, Lear conceived and began working on a portfolio of drawings of birds and animals in the zoological gardens that he intended to market as individual lithographs, sold in sets, with the idea that they would be enjoyed as prints or bound and retained in book form. For a 16 or 17-year-old artist with no experience in publishing and no independent resources to back his venture, this was a remarkably ambitious undertaking. It is significant because it is unquestionably Lear's first self-publishing effort. Though unmentioned by Lear himself or Lear scholars until now, the project has just enough surviving remnants on both sides of the Atlantic to confirm its existence and to raise questions about why it was attempted and why it failed. A single surviving lithographic wrapper for the first part of Lear's work, the detail of which I show here, is owned by the Zoological Society of London. While an original wash study for the Peaceable Kingdom vignette it contained is in one of the youthful albums at Houghton Library at Harvard. Also contained in that same album is a pencil sketch of a polar bear that was to have been one of the plates in Lear's planned portfolio. This is the sketch on the right, and here is the print. And of course, it gets reversed when it's turned into a lithograph. But you can see the original drawing here, and here the final published sketch, of which only one print survives. And this is the only surviving example of another one of his lithographs for the portfolio, this wonderful sleeping lion. Whether Lear lost interest in the project or found it too difficult to fund, we do not know. But in any case, he appears to have abandoned the venture by the end of 1829. Perhaps he had already shifted his focus away from an amorphous audience of general zoo visitors, as shown here in this George Scharf engraving just a couple of years later. It seems he may have chosen to focus instead on a more committed and better funded audience. The new patrons he had identified were a small group of collectors who were interested in acquiring and raising the colorful members of the parrot family as pets and as status symbols. These exotic birds, always popular with the aristocracy, were, in the 1820s and 30s, arriving in London from Australia, Africa, and South America in increasing numbers. They were being acquired at considerable expense, not just by the zoo, but by private collectors for inclusion in the aviaries found on some of the great country estates throughout the British Isles. Lear was fascinated by these birds and saw in their owners a possible audience for his artistic talent. In April 1830, at the age of 18, Lear requested permission from the Council of the Zoological Society had access to their parrots for the purpose of creating a book on the subject. Permission was granted, and for the next 2 years, Lear spent much of his time drawing these colorful creatures from life. We're fortunate that at least 30 of Lear's working drawings and paintings for this great parrot monograph still survive. They impart a sense of excitement and spontaneity that is almost without precedent in the history of scientific illustration. Here's what I'm going to be showing you through that, much more exciting than the wrapper. And I love all the little colored patches that he puts around the edges as he's testing out his work. Even Audubon's studies from this period, most of which were made from dead specimens, failed to capture the sense of vitality that can be seen in many of Lear's studies. I mention Audubon here not just because his name is so much better known as a bird painter here in the United States, but because he is one of the very few other artists of the period who had comparable ability. Although Lear was a full generation younger than Audubon, the two began work on their respective books in London in the very same year, 1827. Unlike Lear, Audubon's production was something of a team effort. He generally limited his own paintings to the birds and had assistants paint the backgrounds and floral details. He also had the help of Robert Havell Jr., arguably the best engraver of the 19th century, who took Audubon's paintings and turned them into magnificent hand-colored double elephant folio aquatine prints that we so admire today. By contrast, Lear did everything himself, including the transfer of his watercolor studies onto lithographic stone for printing, a process at which he was almost completely self-taught and something of a pioneer. It was undoubtedly this tremendous talent, both in painting and printmaking, that drew the attention and admiration of John Gould. Gould, who would become the greatest natural history book publisher of the 19th century, was the chief taxidermist and curator at the London Zoo when Lear began working on his parrot monograph there. He was a mentor to Lear, but also something of a competitor, for he was just then beginning to launch his own career as an author and publisher of ornithological books. From the moment Lear published his spectacular book on parrots, Gould began to court him, offering to employ the financially stressed younger artist as an illustrator and an instructor to his wife, Elizabeth. This may have been an act of generosity toward Lear, but it was undoubtedly also a self-interested one. For the business-savvy Gould decided it was much better to have Lear working for him than against him as a publisher of fine bird books. Like Lear, Gould's wife Elizabeth was an entirely self-taught artist, but she was far less competent than Lear. Gould had charged her with making all the plates for his first book, and she was struggling to do so while also trying to raise a young family. Here is one of Elizabeth Gould's illustrations for John Gould's book on Himalayan birds. And here is another. And I showed this one in particular so that you can compare Elizabeth Gould's owl with an owl plate made at about the same time by Edward Lear. And here you can see the two illustrations side by side. Fortunately, the two artists got along well, and Lear was able to improve Elizabeth Gould's style in the years they worked together. This charming sketch by Lear of a pet field vole kept by Elizabeth Gould hints at the close personal relationship the two developed as they worked together under John Gould's demanding supervision. It is contained in one of Lear's two youthful albums owned by the Houghton Library. Lear and John Gould had a complex relationship. According to letters written by Lear at the time, Gould was very helpful to Lear as he worked on his parrot monograph and on commissions for other publishers. He bought Lear's unsold inventory of the parrot book, some 50 copies in all, totaling 2,100 hand-colored lithographs. And he took Lear on his first trip to continental Europe to visit zoos and natural history collections there sometime about 1833. In return, Lear made some 68 magnificent plates for Gould and for his five-volume work on the birds of Europe. I'm showing you here the Great Auk. It's one of my favorites. As well as 10 plates of the 34 in John Gould's monograph on toucans. In later years, Lear complained that Gould was driving and heartless, exploiting all those who worked for him, including his wife. Lear had reason to be resentful, for just as Audubon failed to credit those who worked for him, Gould sometimes denied Lear the credit that was due for his work. In this plate, which Lear made to illustrate Gould's monograph of toucans in 1834, we can clearly see Lear's signature worked into the composition. This is down here, and I have a detail of it. There, you can see E. Lear, April 1833. Yet the attribution line at the bottom of the print, when it was eventually published, credited only J. and E. Gould, drawn from nature on stone by J. and E. Gould, with no mention of Lear. Gould's defenders would say that this was standard procedure for the time, as Lear was technically worked for hire. Nevertheless, it must have been disheartening for Lear to see his hard work go unacknowledged, and to see Gould making financial success when his own monograph on parrots had been an economic failure. Fortunately, Lear had made a strong enough impression through his own publication that his reputation was secured. When British naturalist William Swainson received his subscription plate of the red and yellow macaw from Lear a few years earlier, he wrote Lear to say that he considered the illustration, quote, equal to any figure ever painted by Barabán or Audubon for grace of design, perspective, or anatomical accuracy. High praise indeed from one of England's most influential ornithologists. Even the cash-strapped Audubon bought a copy of Lear's parrot monograph for himself, something he almost never did, being perpetually short of funds and highly critical of almost every other natural history painter working at the time. Lear's reputation earned him many commissions, including a large number of illustrations for the popular Naturalists Library, edited by William Jardine, in which Lear's work was engraved by William Lazars, the Scottish engraver who had done the first 10 plates for Audubon's Birds of America. Lazars, who had seen the work of many fine artists, including Audubon, once wrote to a friend, quote, "Lear's drawings are nature, and all others pottery ware." During the 1830s, Lear may have helped John and Elizabeth Gould with some of the plates for Charles Darwin's report on the zoological findings of his trip on HMS Beagle. But evidence of this relationship is still, so far, only circumstantial. Lear had many patrons, but by far the most important and most generous patron was Edward Stanley, the 13th Earl of Derby, one of the wealthiest men in England and president of the Zoological Society at the time he first came into contact with Lear. He was well aware of Lear's activities, not only through his zoo connections, but because several of his own birds were featured in Lear's parrot monograph, to which he had been an early subscriber. And I show here a preliminary study Lear made of one of the plates of Stanley's parakeet, now called Stanley's Rosella, or the Western Rosella, on which he is noted, "From a living female or young male lent me by Lord Stanley." In the summer of 1830, Lord Stanley invited Lear to travel north to Knowsley Hall, his sprawling estate near Liverpool. The Earl owned the largest private menagerie in England, with as many as 620 different bird species and more than 20,000 living and preserved animal specimens by the time it was dispersed in 1851. He wished to have Edward Lear document the rarest and most important of these specimens. Despite a warm welcome from the Earl and his extended family, Lear found life at Knowsley Hall very intimidating, and who would live in a building like this? He reported that as many as 30 servants served at every meal. But fortunately for Lear, there were also many children in the hall. When he wasn't working on his more formal portraits of the birds, Lear entertained them with nonsensical poems and fun-filled alphabets. It was at Knowsley Hall that Lear's life as a children's writer and illustrator began. His whimsical drawings cut across all barriers of age and social standing, and he soon found himself treated like a member of the family, even getting rides to and from London with Lord Derby in his personal carriage, something quite unusual in England's highly stratified society. As much as Lord Derby appreciated the fun and laughter Lear brought to Knowsley Hall, it was Lear's talent as a natural history artist that garnered his long-term patronage and support. Lord Derby took the scientific aspects of his collection very seriously. Birds and animals that were raised in his menagerie were carefully documented and preserved after death, both in Lear's paintings and as specimens, which survive today as the core of the natural history collections at the Liverpool Museum. This night monkey of Vito, painted by Lear at Knowsley, was eventually turned into a lithograph, and with 16 other illustrations by Lear, privately published by Lord Derby in 1846, in a book entitled Gleanings from the Menagerie and Aviary at Knowsley Hall. And you see here the original watercolor of this mammal, and here the lithographic print. Lear did not do these lithographs. He was already onto something else by then. And I think you'll agree that the lithograph, although it's quite good, is quite stiff compared to the liveliness of Lear's watercolor. The book was both stunningly beautiful and scientifically significant, with a text by John Edward Gray, the keeper of zoology at the British Museum. Never sold on the open market, Gleanings from the Menagerie now ranks among the rarest and and most sought after of 19th century natural history books. As the decades of the 1830s reached the halfway point, Lear found himself overwhelmed by commissions, including these lovely plates of turtles for his friend Thomas Bell. "I am up to my neck in hurry and work from 5 a.m. till 7 p.m. without cessation," he wrote a friend. Despite the near universal acclaim of his illustrations and the praise they received for their accuracy and beauty, some of Lear's work was still being published without recognition. When Thomas Bell published A History of British Quadrupeds, 1837, he credited two other artists and gave no credit to Lear at all, despite the fact that Lear produced seven illustrations for the book, this being one of them. Fortunately, Lear's own annotated copy of the book survives. In it, he noted each of his contributions in pencil, documenting which plates he had created. So you may not be able to see it where you're sitting, but each one of these says, "Drawn from life by me, Edward Lear." And here's the hedgehog you just saw in watercolor. "Drawn by me, Edward Lear, the water shrew." For the most part, however, Lear was given credit for his paintings. However, in the classic example of being careful what you wish for, Lear was becoming overwhelmed and exhausted by the exacting work he was beginning he was being asked to do. He often complained of his poor health and failing eyesight. "Nothing smaller than an ostrich shall I soon be able to see," he complained to John Gould in 1835. From the time of his first arrival at Knowsley Hall, he found that he enjoyed painting landscapes more than the birds and animals his patron expected. A sketching trip to England's Lake District in 1835 and to Ireland the following year would ultimately convince him that this was the direction he wanted to pursue. Before abandoning his wildlife subjects, however, he came up with an audacious plan in which he could combine his interest in travel and exotic landscape with his patron's love of natural history. Sometime in 1835, when Lear was at the height of his career as a natural history illustrator, he asked Lord Derby if he would approach John James Audubon on his behalf to see if Lear might be able to accompany Audubon on one of his collecting and drawing trips in North America. A more unlikely set of traveling companions one could hardly imagine. Audubon, the heavy-drinking, swashbuckling, womanizing, bigger-than-life French-American with an ego the size of all outdoors, versus the sickly, nearsighted, slightly effeminate, very genteel Englishman with a self-deprecating form of humor that seemed to shield a trunkload of insecurities. Audubon tactfully diffused the idea by pointing out how difficult his upcoming trip was going to be. Lear accepted the rebuff graciously, and neither of the men ever mentioned it again. Still, I've often wondered what such a trip might have been like. With two of the greatest geniuses of wildlife painting ever to live, traveling and working together, who knows what might have emerged. In the years that followed, the two artists went their separate ways. Audubon went on to paint more wildlife subjects in his beloved America, where he could still experience and celebrate wilderness. While Lear pursued his dream of becoming a traveler and painter of landscapes in Europe, the Middle East, and Asia, where he reveled in the breadth and depth of human civilization. Because Audubon stuck to one general subject area throughout his life, he will always be remembered for his naturalist paintings, his paintings in natural history, particularly his birds. Lear's reputation, by contrast, was diffused because of his eclectic interests. His charming and timeless nonsense verse and drawings endured, even as his wildlife paintings were forgotten and his landscapes fell in and out of style. Even though he never focused on natural history professionally after 1837, it's still interested him, and you can find hints of his continuing love of the subject in his later work. Take this view of elephants bathing, painted in 1873. Or this large oil of the Temple of Apollo, which he painted 20 years earlier. It's now owned by the Fitzwilliam Museum in Cambridge. Easily overseen at first, creeping through the foreground, is a detailed painting of a Hermann's tortoise.
Yeah.
Right here. And I have a detail of it here, which gives scientific accuracy to the painting, but also may have been Lear's subtle and humorous attempt at a self-portrait, as if showing himself wandering through the ancient ruins of Greece at a snail's or a tortoise's pace. From 1837 on, Lear was a voracious traveler, covering vast territory during his long life, often spending time in off-the-beaten-path sorts of places. Not shown on this map are his travels up the Nile, of which there's a book here on the table, and in India. And I show all of these arrows coming out of London. He actually was living more that time in Italy, so I should have used that as the base, but the lines began to kind of merge and turn into a big mess, so I made it back to London, because he did go to London just about every year to visit his sister and friends, and actually to try to sell paintings in galleries there. He still had a large family, as you may remember. He was 21. When he was traveling to India, one of the few places not shown on this map, he reveled in the palms and other plant life he saw. "When I go to heaven, if indeed I go," he wrote in 1862, "and am surrounded by thousands of polite angels, I shall say courteously, please leave me alone. Let me have a park and a beautiful view of the sea and hill, mountain and river, valley and plain, with no end of tropical foliage." These quick washes, painted in India toward the end of his life, are, I think, among his most appealing botanical works. By the time of his death in San Remo, Italy, in 1888, he had created almost 400 natural history paintings, more than 7,000 watercolors documenting his travels in Europe, the Mediterranean, the Middle East, and India, and about 2,000 studio watercolors of the same subjects, and more than 300 oil paintings, many of them quite large. He had published 5 illustrated travel books, his monograph on parrots, and more than 200 other lithographs of birds, mammals, and reptiles from various parts of the world. Imitation, it is said, is the sincerest form of flattery, but I would suggest that inspiration might be an equally valid way of charting the influence of an artist. Lear has been inspiring imitators and kindred spirits for almost 200 years. And then in the last few minutes that I have with you this evening, I want to show you the work of a handful of contemporary artists who continue to be inspired by him today. As you might imagine, there are many artists who have created illustrations to accompany Lear's verses. And I'm happy to say that that table is filled with them. Not the ones that I'll be talking about tonight, but a whole set, a different set of artists. I'm showing you here an example of a book by Michel by others here, with his interpretations of Lear. And this interesting version of The Owl and the Pussycat, which was illustrated by the noted children's book illustrator Jan Brett, she gave the subject a Caribbean theme, which is an original conception that uses the words and captures the spirit of Edward Lear, while departing considerably from his much more Spartan, linear style. It's actually quite accurate in terms of the wildlife that she depicts. Looking through the long history of artists inspired by Lear, we find a who's who in children's book illustrators, from Beatrix Potter, who incorporated his stories into many of her illuminated letters to children. I'm showing here one from the Morgan Library and one from Princeton, to rescind that. Who loved Lear's stories so much that he drew one of his own characters from Where the Wild Things Are, reading a copy of one of Lear's books. You can see here, Nonsense, stories and so on, and Alphabets by Edward Lear. Other favorites of mine who drew inspiration from Lear were the late Edward Gorey. I'm showing you here his book on jumblies. And the contemporary artist Barry Mosier. But to talk about all of these would require another lecture. In the field of natural history, there are several notable artists who are today carrying on in the Lear legacy. These include the British artist Elizabeth Butterworth, who has created her own spectacular monographs on parrots that Lear would certainly have admired. And the late Australian artist William Cooper, who's famous for his large format illustrations of birds. His scientific monographs on parrots, toucans, kingfishers, and most recently on pigeons carry the Learian, Gouldian traditions into the 21st century. The American painter Walton Ford has taken this tradition and moved it into the realm of fine art, providing his own considerably darker perspective by creating works of art that contain complex subtexts about human excess and environmental degradation. And although some of these look like 19th century illustrations, they're all relatively recent. Here, the superficial beauty of the birds seduce us into admiring a scene that on closer inspection it's filled with details that portend their ultimate destruction. Ford's paintings they often reveal a rapacious abuse of the natural world and make subtle and sometimes not so subtle references to human savagery and decadence, sex, violence, cruelty, and man-made environmental disasters, which are the sub-themes that run throughout almost all of his work. Another contemporary American painter, James Prosek, plays with the more gentle and whimsical side of Lear's imagination. At left is his painting of an imaginary species he calls the cockatoo. Although not obvious at first, a careful look at Prosek's pictures reveals a variety of Swiss army-like tools emerging from the primary feathers in this bird's wings. And here, in an earlier variation on the same theme, we see the tools appearing in the crest. One could well imagine Lear himself creating a drawing like this in one of his pun-filled letters. In fact, here is one of Lear's whimsical botanicals on the left, next to James Prosek's imaginary bird. And here's a comparison with one of Lear's more strictly scientific plates. Although Prosek's paintings are not directly derived from Lear, the parallels are striking. Like Lear, Prosek loves to play with puns as he explores the meaning of taxonomic classification, as we see in this painting of an imaginary hybrid parrot-fish. One can only imagine how pleased Edward Lear would be to see artists like James Prosek and Walton Ford giving new interpretations to some of the very same subjects that he so enjoyed during the early decades of his life. Lear's extraordinary paintings, and those of the others who continue to probe the boundaries between science, art, and imagination, enrich our lives and make the world a more interesting place. This is the kind of continuing legacy which I'm sure Lear would have enjoyed and encouraged. Who knows what kinds of paintings he himself might have created were he alive today. So I will close with that. Thank you all for your attention. I want to thank Sarah Holliday, especially for her work tonight, getting out these books and making my visit such a pleasure. Thank you. Thank you. we tried to answer any questions anyone might have, either on his natural history or the other aspects of life. Robbie?
How did Lear finance all of his extensive voyages?
Well, yes, you could see from that map, he really did cover an enormous amount of ground. He was always hard up for money. This is kind of the sad story of his life. Even though he produced thousands of paintings, he could barely eke by from one year to the next. But the way it worked, he kept a studio wherever he was. He was in Rome for about 10 years, then he was different parts of Italy. He had an agent in London, and he would have visitation hours, and people could come. And a lot of his English patrons who were on the grand tour would pass through his studio. They'd see a painting and say, oh, I like that, I'll buy that, or could you make something bigger of that same subject? And then Lear would produce something, be paid for it. And that would give him just enough to go on the next trip. He was always trying to find new material. To me, those ones that were done on order are less interesting. It's the original sketches in the field that are the most inspiring. But he did have a steady patronage. Sometimes when he couldn't really sell enough things, he would write to Lord Derby or Lord Derby's successors or one or two of his other friends and say, I'm really having a hard time. Could you help pay for something? And they always would. Also, when he visited places like India, he was staying with friends there. The viceroy was a friend of his. He was very well connected. And so almost all of those trips where he could be a guest, he would be, and didn't cost him nearly as much. Yeah, Jenny?
Where are all these 7,000 landscapes?
Well, yes, that's amazing how productive he was. Surprisingly, most of them, nearly three quarters of them, are at Houghton Library at Harvard. Philip Hoffer, who was the curator of printed drawings there when the library was founded, and then for the next 20 years after that, was an avid Lear admirer and collector himself. And he had been in London right at the end of World War II and had been able to buy a lot of things that were coming on the market then. Lear left a lot of these paintings to his friends in England, and their estates, because the British economy was in such dire straits through World War II, their estates were selling his work. It wasn't in fashion at the time. So sadly, the market was glutted, and the things were being sold for next to nothing. There were two other American collectors who were also snarfing up this material as it came out, and Hoffer befriended them both. Instead of being competitive, he was very smart and realized that there was plenty of Lear to go around, so they were all in it together. He befriended them, and then he convinced them to give their collections to Houghton as well. So the three of them gave their collections all at once. And it was an amazing accomplishment.
Have they been published as a book?
And they've not been published as a book, too many of them. I mean, mine will be the first book that will publish a lot of the natural history ones in that collection. There have been other selected books. There's one on the Indian paintings, but again, only a fraction of them. There have been books on his travels in Albania, in Greece, in various other places, and they published some, but with as many as there are, it will be several lifetimes before they're all in print. I should say that there are other fairly large collections, not nearly as large as the one at Harvard. Yale Center for British Art has, it's probably the second largest collection, and Lord Derby, the current Lord Derby in Liverpool, still has several hundred of the paintings, mostly the natural history work there. So it's, and then it's from other museums and libraries, there are private collections and all over. So part of the fun of working on this book was tracking down where all these pictures were. And I'm hoping that now that the book is out, more will surface. People will be in touch and tell me that they have something or they know someone who does. Perhaps some of you in the audience this evening have Lears. If so, please let me know. I'm always eager to see them. Yes, ma'am.
Did he form lasting friendships with any of the children?
He did with some of them, yes. And there's some correspondence of that. He tended to befriend slightly older friends and those he retained for life as well.
he was good with children, and apparently everyone said children loved to be around him. He was fun and funny, but in large doses they made him nervous. Yes. Yeah, was he as careful with the plants? Yet he was, that's a very good question, actually. He was capable of being very careful with the plants, and he did a fabulous job when he was just focusing on the plants. And even his landscapes in Italy and elsewhere, very accurate and beautifully done. Strangely, in the Parrot monograph, the plants are still almost back to those sort of childhood sketch modes. They're just generic. And it's partly because he hadn't traveled to any of those places. He didn't know what that vegetation looked like. And there is some correspondence where he's asking people to send him plant material and information about plants so he knows what to put in the background. But you will find that quite a few of these animals, and here's an example, this Australian possum that's in front of me here, there's virtually no plant material, just a generic swash of grass around him because he didn't know what the plants Australia were like, and he was so afraid of making a mistake in that area that he'd rather just avoid it. Yeah, yes, sir?
Very specific, I'm sorry. That Temple of Apollo that you showed in Greece, you know where that is? That temple?
That's at the Fitzwilliam, I believe.
No, I mean the temple itself.
Oh, the temple itself. No, I don't. I'm sorry to say.
The famous one, the Temple of Apollo at Passai, where C.R. Cockerell went, the architect of the Ashbourne. Maybe he knew Cockerell?
Oh, may have. I don't know that answer to that. I'm sorry to say. And I don't know the temple. I was doing all the research on the turtle. What species it was. And I had experts all over the country second-guessing and competing, debating each other which turtle it was. But we forgot to check the temple, which was really your primary focus. Any other thoughts or questions? I do encourage you, if you have time, to take a look at some of the books that are out for you. And also, we do happily have a few of the books that David Godin has just published outside. It is not officially published yet. You will not be able to buy these in bookstores. It's still being printed in China. And the batch that you have tonight were FedExed in just a day or two ago so that it could be the Society Library. Thank you all for coming.